Session number 10883, Reel 7.
Michael Rowntree, Reel 7.
After the end of the war, the unit was starting to undertake civilian relief work in northwest Europe, starting before the war had ended in northern France in the devastated areas, and then moving on into Holland and then into Germany, where they were involved with work with displaced persons and people coming out of concentration camps. They were one of the early people into some of the worst German concentration camps. So after being at home on leave for about a month at the end of the war, I was then asked to go out and work with the section in northwest Europe and to take over as section leader from Gerald Gardner, who had been in charge of the section that had moved from France through Holland into Germany and had done interesting work in and among the concentration camp victims. So I went out to Germany in July 1946 and took over after a comparatively short overlap, which I wish had been longer, from Gerald Gardner, who was one of the leading luminaries, of course, as a unit member. He was considerably older than most of us, for one thing, and with much greater experience as a leading barrister and a very eminent person. And he was returning home. He went on a farewell tour of the sections of that were dotted around Germany, because the FAU sections were split up, and there were, I think, about a dozen sections at that time in northwest Europe, and they were stationed in different parts. And Gerald conducted a farewell tour, which was fairly arduous, visiting them all in a certain length of time. And I think that on more than one occasion, he was discovered sort of asleep in his car between visiting one section and another. But the various voluntary societies, of which the FAU was only one, which were involved in civilian relief work in Germany, had established a combined headquarters at a place called Flotow in Germany, which was run under the aegis of the British Red Cross, which occupied the lead position. And the person in charge of the combined headquarters, Colonel Agnew, was the British Red Cross commissioner in northwest Europe. And in that headquarters at Flotow, there were stationed representatives of the various voluntary organizations doing civilian relief work in northwest Europe. Apart from the Friends Ambulance Unit, there was the Friends Relief Service, the other official Quaker relief bodies. There was the British Red Cross, the Salvation Army, the Girl Guides, the Scouts, and probably one or two others that that I've forgotten. And these all had representatives in this headquarters, which was an administrative headquarters, supervising the work which was being done throughout Germany, throughout the British-occupied zone of Germany, mostly among displaced Persians, but also to some extent among the German civilian population.
Were there any specifically Jewish organizations that you know?
Can't recall one in our headquarters, but there could well have been. Don't remember one. I was in charge of the FAU throughout northwest Europe, and I acted as Colonel Agnew's deputy in charge of the, not in charge, but dealing with coordination and liaison with all the voluntary societies in Flotow. And really, for the year that I was out there, from July 45 to July 46, my job was primarily administrative. It was a desk-bound job, largely, in the headquarters at Flotow, with occasional visits to the various FAU sections who were dotted around the British zone of Germany, and one or two sections in Berlin, in the British occupied zone of Berlin. So that it was really liaison deciding to some extent in conjunction with others on policy as to what needed doing where, and occasionally moving sections from place to place and dealing with the finances and personnel matters of this kind. So I wasn't at work on the coalface, so to speak, in that year. It was very much an administrative job at headquarters. Also liaising, of course, and keeping in contact with our own FAU headquarters in London at Gordon Square.
How efficient do you think the organisation was?
How efficient?
Yes, all these different organisations working together on relief, you know.
Well, it was, I mean, given that there were voluntary organisations all anxious to do this kind of work, it was obviously better that they should be coordinated at some level than all operating entirely independently. There might be some who would argue that it would have been better if one organisation, say the British Red Cross, was conducting the whole operation. But in fact, things don't work that way. And I think given the fact that people had their own loyalties and had been working in their own organisations, many of them, of course, throughout the war, and had got to know their own way, ways of operating, I think on the whole it operated reasonably successfully. I think there were some frictions in deciding which organisation should operate in which place or on which kind of a job. And no doubt some friction always between the combined headquarters in the field and the individual headquarters of different organisations back in London, where you tend to get different mentalities growing up between one body which has only loyalties to its own particular constituency and a combined body that begins to develop sort of group loyalties among themselves. But I think this is to some extent inevitable in the way that the world works, and I think that it operated reasonably effectively.
Would the FAU have been the only pacifist relief organisation?
Well, FRS, of course, was there too, which was, you might say, even more pacifist than the FAU, in that it was an official Quaker body, whereas we weren't, and had always not accepted willingness to work during the war with the army. So they were more pacifist than us, if you can put it in that way. But yes, the others were not pacifist organisations, though all internationally minded.
Do you think as pacifist you brought something special to relief work?
Well, I would like to think that we did, and it clearly the motivation added, it had a different, an extra dimension, I think, from the merely, not merely, that sounds patronising, but the just the goodwill and a natural inclination that people have to help in a situation like that. I think that also it perhaps made us more inclined to forget the past and view the ordinary German population more charitably than some of the other organisations who perhaps were less inclined to overlook some of the atrocities that had gone on, or perhaps more inclined to ascribe blame to the whole population and not just to individuals who had done this. So I think there was a slight difference in emphasis there. Whether that rubbed off on any of the other organisations, I wouldn't like to say.
Now, I was wondering, you know, about this rule of non-fraternisation with the Germans and whether the FAU and the FRS took a different attitude.
I think we were more, yes, I think we were more inclined to breach the regulations and think that we had a higher loyalty than other organisations. I think that's certainly true. It did produce a certain amount of awkwardness and restriction on us. I don't think it was a rule that was very widely enforced, or at any rate, it was comparatively easy to ignore it. And I suppose because the Control Commission weren't sure of their relationship to voluntary organisations and what powers they had over us, they really didn't trouble us very much. But certainly we were never had any difficulty. For instance, the small group of Quakers in Germany, of German Quakers, who were based at Bad Pyrmont, not too far away from us, with whom we made early contact and with whom we went and with whom we went over quite frequently to hold meetings for worship, there was never any inhibition or difficulty about meeting with them. Nor do I think really that there was any great difficulty in dealing quite reasonably and amicably with the ordinary German civilians around the place that one met. We had a number of German staff in the headquarters, and there was never any ban on fraternizing with them particularly. I think it can have been so little of a problem that I had largely forgotten about it by now as being something that that might have worried about us. And certainly it isn't something that's lingered in my memory as a major problem.
Did you have any idea how the Quakers had fared in Germany during the war? Now, you mentioned how you met them at this time. Did you get feedback from them?
Some of them had been in concentration camps. I think probably one or two had died in concentration camps. Not all of them, I think, had been put away, though obviously I think probably a higher proportion had been put in concentration camps or dealt with harshly by the authorities than in the population at large. But they are a comparatively small group, while I think they had certainly suffered persecution, nothing like as much as, for instance, the Jews as a race.
Did you actively seek reconciliation, do you think, in Germany? The FAU and the FRS, did you go out of your way?
Yes, to the extent, I think, that we would always try and seek reconciliation with individual Germans where we could. Though one always had to bear in mind that you never quite knew with whom one was dealing, and that no doubt some of the more wicked of the Germans, Nazis, were quite good at dissembling their past. And undoubtedly, I mean, some of the hard luck cases that one came across were people who had an extremely evil or undesirable past. But because my job was largely administrative, I didn't myself come across Germans in the volume that I think members of the teams working out in the countryside did. A good deal of my work was dealing with British members of the Control Commission rather than Germans, so to speak. So I was, to some extent, slightly insulated personally, I think, compared with the people who were, and the members of the teams, who were actually dealing with the German population and seeing much more at first hand of the devastation and suffering, both the suffering that was caused by the Germans and the suffering that was caused as a result of the war. I mean, some of the teams, and it was really, most of this was before I arrived in Germany, some of the teams had some very horrendous times dealing with the concentration camp inmates and the results of the concentration camp. And I can't help thinking that their views of Germans must have been somewhat different from those of us who perhaps hadn't seen quite so much of that active horror and evil. Equally, other teams were in very close touch and dealing day to day with the traumas and problems of the displaced persons, which had been caused by the activities of the Germans. So again, they had seen much more closely and personally the horrors and the results, both of the Nazi evil and the Nazi persecution, and of the devastation caused by war. Looking back on it, I can't help feeling really that I was quite extraordinarily insulated from the worst aspects of the situation in Germany. I did get around because part of my job was going around visiting the various teams, but on the whole, it did not involve so much seeing them in their work and the nature of their work and the kind of things that they were doing, though I did see some of that, as probably discussing their within the teams personnel problems or what they saw as their future development of their work and this kind of thing. So I can't really speak from personal experience so much as those who were actively engaged in the relief work in the field. One did see a good deal of devastation, particularly when I went to visit the team in Berlin. I mean, Berlin was physically absolutely devastated, and I did meet one or two of the two Quakers in Berlin who really, I think, had a very tough time during the war.
How about the Control Commission? You know, your relations with that?
Perfectly amicable. I think probably they were glad to have help in dealing with the problems that they were coping with from whatever quarter it might arise. The problems of pacifism, of course, didn't arise so acutely as during the war, because they were, although they were a military body, they were a sort of halfway between the military and the civilian body. And except on, I suppose, on this issue of fraternization and non-fraternization, we probably weren't all that different from any other voluntary agency that was operating within Northwest Europe. So I don't think that they probably looked at us in quite the same way as had happened during the war.
Because the unit went into Germany very soon, as you've explained, didn't they? After the
they did. Really, before I got there, you see, the war had ended in May, and I think the unit had been probably into Germany before then. I'm not clear on dates, but I think they'd been working in northern France and then Holland, and I think they'd probably gone into Germany before the end of hostilities in May. Well, I didn't arrive there until maybe the end of July or early August, I can't remember. So that was, what, nearly 3 months after the end of hostilities. So I didn't personally see the worst of the horrors, or indeed the worst of the situation in Germany. I mean, obviously the physical destruction was still there when I got there, but an element of organisation had taken place in the 3 months before I arrived. There were still lots of displaced persons on the move and milling around, but by and large they'd mostly been accommodated in camps by the time I was there, whereas at the time of the end of hostilities and for a while afterwards, they were still milling around on the roads and moving hither and thither, and there were still the concentration camps to deal with.
Do you think the FAU had an advantage, you know, in your sort of small mobile teams, that they could be flexible and respond to a situation and go to fill in any gap? I remember Gerald Gardner telling me about Belsen, how he sort of activated things when he went in.
I think that that's probably true. I think the unit, from having operated throughout the war on a rather curious basis, had become accustomed to being flexible and sometimes barging in where, you know, one might say, where angels feared to tread. It was a pretty flexible organization. It was perhaps less hierarchical than some of the others, and I think that they perhaps were able to take decisions on the spot a little more easily than some of the others, but I wouldn't like to ascribe too much virtue to the unit for that. But I think if Gerald felt that was the position when they went in, I would certainly be inclined to agree that he was right and that that was so. I think by the time I got there, things had settled down to a degree, and that therefore there was rather less scope for individual initiative, in that a structure had been set up, a bit of a chain of command. You'd got the Control Commission, you'd now got a headquarters run by the British Red Cross, and rather more of an organised plan as to what was to be done in any situation, so that I think possibly it had become a little more structured, and the opportunities for snap decisions and decisions of that kind were rather less. But yes, basically, I think probably the unit has always been a body that that prided itself on being flexible and being able to adapt to circumstances. Whether that was in all cases true, I don't know, but certainly I think it did have some effect, yes.
Was it difficult following someone like, or sort of filling in the position you took over from Gerald Gardner?
Well, it was in the sense that Gerald, of course, was a highly respected person of much greater maturity and greater experience, and therefore obviously would carry much more weight in the in dealings with higher up people in Control Commission or wherever. I was, in 46, I was still only 27, which is relatively junior and youthful, so that I did feel, I think, some sense of inadequacy at following Gerald Gardner, who was undoubtedly one of the most able and distinguished members of the FAU during the whole of its career. On the other hand, I suppose that the very fact that he had established a reputation by being the leader for the time that he was, he had, I suppose, eased the path of his successor in dealing with authorities, in that he'd attained a certain degree of credibility for the organisation and respect for him as its leader. But he could be quite intimidating, Gerald, though a delightful personality.
In what way?
Well, he had a barrister, he had a barrister's, or could have, way of wanting to get at the facts, and could express himself with great clarity at the whole time. And I think one was made sometimes a bit more conscious of woolliness in thought and expression than one might otherwise have been when not faced with such a formidable intellect and formidable powers of expression. I mean, he would, in discussion of a problem, he could see the options open very clearly and would set them out and would want to know what your view of the right course was, at a time when those of us with rather slower mental functions were still grasping as to what kind of thing one ought to be doing.
He seemed to have cared very deeply for the teams, though.
Oh, very. I mean, he was an intensely human personality. And I don't want to give the impression at all that he in any way traded on the undoubted superiority of intellect that he had. And he was and still is, a deeply caring personality, of course. as exemplified, I think, by the fact that he went on retaining his interest in the Friends Ambulance Unit, the successor bodies, after the war, long after he needed to, and when he was by then occupying a very distinguished role in the councils of the nation, and always at a very human level, and always very concerned about the welfare of individual people. No, he's a great man, is Gerald, and a wonderful chap.
Because later in your life, you were chairman of Oxfam, weren't you? And I wondered if you gained any lessons from your experience of relief work in Germany, which stood you in good stead in that role.
Well, I think what my experience in the FAU as a whole did do was to focus and direct my interest into problems of international problems and problems of people who are suffering. Of course, at the time during the war and after the war, it was things like displaced persons and so forth. It wasn't so much the question of underdeveloped countries as Oxfam became involved in, though refugees certainly, I mean, was a link that went on into Oxfam, because in its early days particularly, through World Refugee Year and things like that, Oxfam was very deeply concerned with the problems of refugees. So, and my slight involvement with the Syrian clinics in the early days had certainly given me a bit of a view of the kind of problems that the poorer nations were facing when there was nothing in the way of health or other facilities. So I think that certainly my 7 years in the FAU gave me the impetus to go on and retain an interest in that kind of problem. And I think led me, when I went to Oxford in 1950, and of course my job, led me then very quickly to become interested in Oxfam, partly because of the work it was doing, partly because Oxfam has always had very close links with Quakers and the Society of Friends, and the then director of it, Leslie Kirkley, was a Quaker, and other Quakers were closely involved in its organisation. So I think that certainly the FAU was seminal in directing me towards an interest in Oxfam. I think my own personal experience of relief work was probably so limited and in an extent so out of date by the time I became chairman of Oxfam that I wouldn't like to say that had all that much relevance. I think it was really more in directing my own interest and through the Society of Friends into the kind of attitudes and the kind of work that Oxfam was involved in.
It would seem from what you say that these 7 years were very important to your life.
Oh, they were very important, yes. Well, first of all, of course, they were extremely interesting and I think must have been character-forming in some ways. And though I don't think it necessarily had much influence in directing the nature of my professional career, which was in newspapers, I think it certainly fostered an interest in my extracurricular activities through Oxfam and through the Friends Service Council and the practical side of the Society of Friends, so to speak. I mean, I served on quite a number of Quaker committees of that kind, and I think that was all a legacy of the experience I'd had in the FAU. What I would have done if I hadn't been in the FAU or if war hadn't broken out, I just don't know, and probably fruitless to speculate. I certainly had no ideas in 1939 when I was still an undergraduate as what I was going to do with my life or what my career was. And I think that the FAU certainly gave me a much greater interest in the kind of things that I did get involved in through Oxfam and Friends Relief and Friends Service Council than if I hadn't been in the FAU. Yeah.